On behalf of Ecumenica Journal, this is Bradley Griffin, and it's my privilege today to talk with internationally known performance artist, director, and painter Rachel Rosenthal. In just a few weeks, Ms. Rosenthal will celebrate her 83rd birthday with a celebration here in Los Angeles. And in addition, she has a new book forthcoming from Routledge, and she continues to lead her performance workshops, The DBD Experience, on a regular basis. I look forward to hearing about all these things and more. Ms. Rosenthal, welcome.
Thank you.
It's been 20 years since you recorded an oral history for the Smithsonian's Archives of American Art with Moira Roth. And at the end of that interview, you said that you were, quote, increasingly trying to see the big picture and to try to enlarge the tunnel vision that I feel is prevalent in our dealings with each other and with other species and with the planet as a whole. So I'd like to begin by asking, how has your work as a performer, a director, and a visual artist over the last two decades enabled you to see that bigger picture?
Well, I think it's a sort of an exchange. I feed the performances, and the performances feed me back. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if I can completely agree with you that it only goes one way. I have been very, very much attached to the planet since, I would say, the 50s, and growing more and more attached over the years. And so in my work, first of all, I would read a lot of material. I would read a lot of books about all the issues that are now front page, which nobody paid attention to in those days. And I was very much appalled at the fact that people didn't pay attention to what, to me, was the most important issues in our lifetime, which is, of course, the way we treat the climate, the way we treat each other, the way we treat other species, the way we treat the Earth. And I got very interested then in the cosmos, and in the whole story of our universe, and I still am. As a matter of fact, I hope I don't die soon, because I think that the new discoveries will be really remarkable, and I want to be around to hear what happens next. In all my performances, as well as the Q&A that I usually do after a performance, and in the lectures, and in my teaching, my classes, I always try to open up our small world, which is very tiny, really, and that people are focused on, and open that focus grandly. We need to understand more about the planet and its workings. We need to understand much more about other species that coexist on our planet. We need to understand where we're going in the development of the cosmos and the galaxy and so on. Because all of those things are what we are made of, and those are our parents, basically, and we come from that, and we need to understand more so that we can help something, you know, in what seems to me to be a disaster coming, and we need to somehow stop that disaster, but only knowledge will help. So I've tried to immerse myself in that and to put it out, and I always am amazed that it took decades for those issues to be front page.
And in the beginning of your answer to that question, you anticipated my follow-up question, because you said it wasn't only a one-way street, that it was an exchange. So I was going to ask, do you think we as a society, as a world, have learned anything in that 20 years, or do we still see through tunnel vision?
I think that because of overpopulation, which to me is one of the major issues on our planet, overpopulation of ourselves, and the fact that we are stealing habitat from all the others, because of that, the issues that take our interest and our total focus these days are very personal. How can I live, you know, and make enough money to sustain myself and my family if I have a family? This is mainly what people think about. And so even though the information is there in amounts that are completely new for that information, I'm afraid that people ignore it, even though they learn it, but they ignore it. They let it drop and then put their focus back onto ourselves and our existence. And so this is a real problem, because even though I am happy to see that there is much, much more that is being taught and said and looked at very closely, and people know a lot. You know, information is there and people know it. But to do something about it, that's the question.
You have described your involvement with the feminist movement, and particularly your work with Woman Space and Grandview here in Los Angeles, as a liberating experience, a time when you discovered, in your own words, that women could be artists. As you look back on those experiences from the early 1970s and you compare them with the experiences of women artists today, do you think it has become easier for women to share their work, to speak?
Yes, I do. I do. I think there's been a lot of success in that direction. But it's still far from what it should be in terms of equality, and that goes with art and with any other kind of occupation that women and men have. It's still men, you know, who make more money and who are noticed and who are singled out and so on much more than women. But I also think that a lot of women have had to navigate very difficult oceans in terms of their equality, because for so many millennia, women who wanted to assert their importance and their place in society have been trampled, basically, and have been taught certain modes of being in relationship to their own existence and existing on a planet that is half and half sexes. And they've learned these things, which were helpful in just surviving, you know, how to be nice, how to, you know, help the men, how to be behind them and boost them and maybe even, you know, do their job under their name, and all the things, you know, that women have learned to do in order to have a place somehow and in the society. So today we don't do that much, and men resent it, and men are a little bit lost. They don't know what their role is in all of this. Women are not quite sure what their role is in all of this. You know, I come from a family, a mother and a father, who were the absolute models for role-playing. My father was the man, my mother was the woman, and there was absolutely no problems in that respect. It was established and it worked beautifully. It was, you know, it just worked. And I saw that, you know, and I said to myself, oh, bullshit, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with that, you know. But they were happy and they loved each other dearly. And they worked their lives together in that way. And I saw that very clearly. So I think that we have a long way to go in order to be comfortable in this world and to recognize, you know, what the strong points are in men, what the strong points are in women, and how to allow those points to express themselves without fear. Because, you know, as well as I do, that we live really in a society where in some countries being cross-dressing or anything like that can bring you death. And sometimes even worse, you know, torture and death. So we haven't really made that much progress, maybe in this country, but on the globe in general, we still have a long way to go.
Do you have the experience of other women artists coming to you and telling you that your early work made it possible for them to create their work? Do those kinds of conversations happen?
It's not so much a conversation. It's a lot of post-workshop letters that I get, which always astound me, that tell me, you know, that I changed their lives, that I opened up their all their possibilities, that they finally have found their way, you know, a lot of things of that nature. And, of course, it makes me feel good. And I'll tell you, just between you and me, I don't take credit for that. I feel that whatever I do and whatever I teach comes from somewhere else and that I'm just a conduit. And it seems to work that way in my life because very often when I'm teaching, for instance, to give you an example, I'll start a sentence and I don't know how I'm going to end it. And it just blah, 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 comes out of my mouth. Oh, look, yeah, I guess I believe that. Yeah, that's a good one, you know. But this is how I function.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about taking credit for your work. In the interview with Moira Roth, you were talking about instant theater and how it was years afterward that you were able to take credit for the work that you were doing there. I don't know if that's modesty or self-effacement or maybe just a little bit of discomfort with being called a pioneer in a field, but I'm not surprised that you do get those kinds of letters talking about the effect of your work because it is and has been a groundbreaking path that you have trod.
You should read some of those things. It's amazing. You know, when I read those letters, I think, oh, wow, you know, this is great. And yet, I don't know, it's in my nature, you know, not to bask in all this applause mm-hmm. and to just keep going and do my best.
Mm-hmm. From your perspective as a pioneer in the field of performance art, are there still challenges that are unique to women artists, and perhaps you want to just expand that to artists in general, or to use an image from your own Pangean dreams, have the tectonic plates dividing the work of men and women shifted into a position of mutual acceptance or mutual cooperation?
Well, that's a very good question. I put out a very safe atmosphere in my workshops. And everybody there is safe. And also, I find that I attract gay people, probably because I don't put any emphasis on gender in any way. And gender always comes up and gets expressed because that's what we are. We're this or we're that, etc. And in our society, it's very much divided with its own good and bad points, you know, emphasized. But when I look at my people, you know, in a class or in a workshop, all I see is energies. I don't see genders or bodies in that way at all. And I think that that kind of translates a little bit in the atmosphere of how other people experience it. And I would hope so. You know, because I think there's much too much emphasis made on gender and the differences and the, you know, the kinds of things you're allowed if you're this or if you're that, not allowed, et cetera, et cetera. So, my goodness, when I think of my present pool of artists in my new company, I have so many gay men. And I love to work with them because they have a sensibility which is close to mine. But I don't know, it's a very tricky point and people still suffer from it, which makes me sad.
Mm-hmm. In talking about your performance, Bonsoir, Dr. Schoen, you've said that you were initially resistant to the idea of appearing naked on stage, that going naked in front of an audience was, in your words, abominable. And yet you overcame your fear because the piece demanded the nudity. I'm wondering, is there anything in your art that scares you today? Do you still have to push yourself through boundaries of personal comfort in order to make discoveries?
In all my work, it's been hard. And nothing comes easily. And so today it's different because since 2000 I don't perform myself. And so everything has to flow into the energy of the group. And I find since I'm completely immersed in my favorite thing in life, you know, which is total improvisation, to do total improvisation the way we do it is so difficult. And it's so scary because you come to an evening, you know, the audience comes in, they've paid for their tickets, they expect something or other, and you have absolutely no concept of what's going to happen that night, whether it's going to be a fantastic show or a lousy one. Nobody knows. And so I feel a tremendous responsibility because in spite of myself, I mean a lot to the group and to the atmosphere that develops at a certain time. And so I want it to be fantastic, and sometimes I feel that I haven't given all that I should give, or I've given something which, you know, derailed a little bit. And this is my worry right now, because my worry is no longer my own performance, but it's theirs.
Let's talk for a bit about your work as the creator and artistic director of Instant Theater in the 1950s and 60s. In reflecting on that period, you've said that much of your work in Instant Theater was years, artistically speaking, maybe light years ahead of the practices that would develop and be co-opted by later performance artists and even mainstream theater practitioners. How did those practices of Instant Theater evolve?
Let me see. Well, it evolved like everything else in life. It just happens. Wonders happen or shit happens. But the truth of the matter is that all my life I've been devoted to improvisation. And this has been, you know, my calling, basically. But when I was going to school, I, of course, did the scenes like everything else, everybody else. But there were always workshops that had some improvisation, especially in Europe, not so much here. And then when I moved to California, I took a job with the Pasadena Playhouse. And they hired me and then they threw me out after the semester because that was a bit much for them. And I was out in the world, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And Vanessa Brown had a salon at the time, once a week. And all these young would-be, you know, artists and actors came there, and she would lecture to us and so on. And then we developed a workshop. And people like Vic Morrow and like Tab Hunter and people, you know, young artists of that nature were part of it. And it was very interesting because we had no place for our workshop. She never actually rented anything. So we ended up in a restaurant that had a second floor. And we were able once a week to use that space that they had on the second floor. But it was always, you know, we were doing theater and you would hear all the noise of the restaurant at the same time. So I started to look for another place and I found a wonderful little workshop on El Centro in East Hollywood, well, in Middle Hollywood. And the owners had never rented it, but they did because the owner was in the hospital at the time and they weren't using it. So I said, I'm taking it. And I brought it to Vanessa and I said, this is terrific. It's exactly what we need. She said, no. And I said, no? This is perfect. Why no? And she never said why. And then later on I found out that it was because of the McCarthy era. Some of the people who worked there in the Circle Theater were blacklisted. And so she wanted nothing to do with that. And I said, okay, I'm leaving you and I'm going to start my own workshop. And that's how it all started. So in that little workshop, I kind of brought half of her people to me and half stayed with her. And we continued our way, you know. And at first it was all scenes as usual. And then when they didn't do their homework, I would give them my exercises, which I would think up, you know, and invent. And they were really thrilled with my exercises and didn't do any more scenes. And so what I would do would be to get on my bed at about 4:30 in the afternoon, and for about an hour or two, I would be in kind of a limbo state, and ideas would come to me. And that's how I started to build the exercises that later on became Instant Theater. And it was a pretty amazing period because it started, you know, with almost nothing. We had no lights. We had just hand lights that we maneuvered, you know, like that. And we would look at the garbage before the trucks came, because in those days there were no garage sales. So we found all these wonderful props and pieces of materials and God knows what in the garbage. And we brought that in, you know, and we started using these props in ways which were unusual, to say the least. And little by little, the people who were showing at the Ferris Gallery, which was the only gallery that really showed good art around here in that period, would come every weekend to see us play. So it just moved like this from one little step to another without my even trying, just out of its own being. It was there, it was seen, it was appreciated, and it grew.
And amazing things continue, I think, to come from that. I mean,
I got to tell you something, though, that I didn't mention. Things became such that I was looking at what I was seeing on stage with my students, and it was remarkable. I had never seen anything like that. I said, we've invented a new form of theater, and it is fantastic. We have to go public. And they all left. They said my agent wouldn't want to see me do anything that crazy, that weird.
To stick with the mainstream.
And yes,
to be seen doing something like that.
Three people stayed. They were not actors. And the four of us created Instant Theater.
I realize I'm jumping across decades, but are there practices of Instant Theater that have resurfaced as practices in the DBD workshop experience?
Yes, definitely. Yes, it's all like, you know, one continuum. And all the things that I created in Instant Theater and developed in Instant Theater then became DBD, which was the weekend workshop that I give. And then I started to rebuild companies. And I had a company that performed with me in the 90s, very many pieces that were both directed and rehearsed, and also a tohu bohu kind of work that was all improvisation and which I'm reviving and going to launch in February of 2010. Fantastic. So it's a thread.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Several years ago at an Association of Theater and Higher Education conference, I heard Una Chowdhury speak about her then new work in animal studies and zoesis. I know that you're an advocate of animals and that you've adopted dozens, if not hundreds, of animals during your life. How do animals inspire you today?
Oh, I couldn't live without them. First of all, my love for them. You know, this is where I put all my love. I have a lot of people around me, and I kind of love them, but not the way I love animals. They teach me so much about how to live in this world, because let's face it, most of those animals and those species have been here so much longer than we have and have learned how to live here, because It's an extraordinary planet, which is very hospitable, but that has its problems. And we feel those problems, I think, just as much as the animals, and maybe more, because they're used to it more. They've been around for so many millennia, which we haven't. So they teach me. I watch them, their philosophy. They have a philosophy of life that is much more adaptive than ours. We're always fighting nature, and they are always gliding with nature, We always fight each other. We create adversaries, and they don't do that. Adversaries are usually just for two things, food and reproduction, and they have to make it, We don't need to do that most of the time, but we create other kinds of, fights with both with nature and with each other. And so some of us do learn from animals, I think, a great deal. And right now there's even a show at the L.A. Louvre, in Venice, by Gwen, what is her last name? She's a wonderful sculptor who does only animals. And there's a lot of artists who have learned from animals. Musicians have learned from animals. So I have a great deal of respect for not only the individual animal, but also for the state of being an animal. And I bring that into my work a great deal. I try to get people to stop being people so much, and to try to get into the skin of other animals and learn ways of being, ways of moving that is completely different from what they're used to doing and comfortable with. So there is a discomfort at first, but then there's a great learning that comes from that.
In your own performance as Coco in Rachel's Brain, it's an astonishing performance, because you really lose the human performer and you see the animal emerge so clearly. And it's such a beautiful way that you combine the animal, Coco's text, and then, the way that you compare it to the human's text. It's an amazing transformation that you can tell that you really are living out what you're describing here.
Thank you.
The reviews of your work describe you, and I'm quoting here, as inspirational, a shaman, a Delphic voice, and someone whose performances tread the line between spirituality and political commentary. Could you talk a bit about, and you've mentioned it, but maybe talk a bit more about the spiritual influences of your work? And I realize that you don't work in a Judeo-Christian context, but I'm talking about the influence of Zen or your connection to the Earth Goddess or other similar influences.
Well, I would say that, animism is probably where I'm comfortable, because I do believe in the spirit in some way, shape, or form. I don't know how, but I think that there is spirit in everything, and especially in other species. And what we do with other animals and what we do to them is abominable, is the best word for it, for most part. And I'll tell you something. Recently, I saw an old film that was done by a woman called Passion in the Desert. And when it came out, it was completely misunderstood and thrown into the garbage. And I saw this film on Turner Classics, and I TiVo'd it, and I fell in love with it and the people and non-people in it. It's a story of a Napoleonic soldier in that period when they were trying to annex Egypt. And he finds himself in the desert. He's lost. To make a long story short, he is befriended by a leopard who lives in the cave that he took refuge in. And it's a story of their relationship, which is almost human. There's tremendous amount of love. There's a hint of bestiality, if you want to look at it that way. But mainly, it's how that young soldier, that young man, learns to live in nature by himself, because there's no other people around, and yet with the friendship and love and maybe sex with that leopard. And it's very interesting to me to see the story being shown on the screen and people really freaking out. And yet I look at it and I think, wow, you know, this is fantastic. This is beautiful. This is, you know, it really makes me feel good. And I wanted to know more about the artist, the actor, the animals who did the show, you know. And yet there is still, it's a little bit like for women, of course, there is still so much misunderstanding in the world that places, again, the human on some kind of pinnacle and everything else is down on the garbage heap. And animals that are so close to us and that we are only now beginning to scientifically discover how intelligent they are, how close they are genetically. These animals are tortured and killed and maimed and all of that by us all the time, every day. And there's, you know, so much horror in that area. So I do believe very, very strongly that we are made of the same material and that we have differentiated in different ways, but there is nothing that says that speaking English gives you some kind of privilege that not speaking English doesn't have, you know. And so I'm very, very grateful always for my relationships with animals. And I have had a relationship with a cat that has lasted, you know, decades, even after her death.
This is DBD you're talking
DBD.
About? Yes. It was an amazing story that I read in the Moira Roth interview where you recount that. It's an incredible story.
It's in my book also, and yes. I always talk about that story at the end of the DBD experience, which is the weekend workshop, because I feel that hopefully it teaches people something about what it is to be an animal.
Was or is spirituality and perhaps animism, as you've focused on it here, something that you consciously would think about when you would begin creating a new piece? Or were you surprised when you stepped back after finishing the piece to find areas or evidences of spirituality in your work?
Well, you know, it's funny because I would put a tremendous amount of work in each piece. Then I would perform it. And I would perform it once, and then I'd perform it twice, and I'd perform it three times, and sometimes 10 times, sometimes 15 times. And it's only with all those added performances that I would begin to understand why I did something, why I put something in there, you know. It would come the way my teaching comes, you know, like being a conduit. And those things would come and I would put them in because they felt right. But sometimes I just wouldn't know why. And then slowly, after playing it and playing it and playing it, one day I would say, so that's why I did this, you know. So this is a little bit how I functioned in that respect. And again, when I did Tohu Bohu with my company in the 90s, I performed with them. It was before 2000 when I stopped. And now I'm kind of letting them loose on the boards, and they're going to do Tohu Bohu without me. And so I'm watching also what happens to these people as we workshop it and as we learn how to do this. And I notice, little by little, such changes, such enormous transformations in them. And I know that this kind of work has a meaning and a need and a reason for being, which goes sometimes beyond our understanding. And I don't push it and I don't talk about it and I don't make it a big to-do, because I don't want people to be self-conscious about it, but it's definitely there. It's magic.
I know that in your workshops and in Tohu Bohu, you're emphasizing improvisation, but in the pieces that you have created, that you have performed on a number of times, does it come from improvisation? Does it come from automatic writing that you then go back and look through? What's your process?
No. What happened was this. When I was doing Instant Theater, of course, I was participating all the time, and it was improvisational. Well, all those decades that led to Instant Theater, I had very, very bad degenerative arthritis in my knees. And finally, in the mid-60s, I just couldn't move anymore the way I wanted to move. And so I stopped Instant Theater for a while. And in 75, somebody approached me and said, do a performance in our gallery. It was two guys who had a gallery in the Valley. And so I said, well, okay, I can do that. And in that performance, which was the first one of that nature that calls itself performance art, it was about the knees. And I realized that because I couldn't move the way I did before, I had to put something else in that was equally important, and text was it. And so I started to write text and learn text. So in most of my pieces, the text is learned and it's always used as is. But the way I present the text and the movements that I do and the actions that I do were left very open to improvisation. So this is how all those pieces developed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Since retiring from performance in 2000, you've turned more attention to painting, and your work has been shown at the Centre Pompidou and at many museums throughout California and the U.S. How does the process of creating a painting compare with creating a performance?
It's all the same. And, you know, I never stopped visual arts. I started out when I was 3 and I kept going. And even when I was doing Instant Theater or any of my other performances, I always did some kind of visual art. And I did sculpture and I did ceramics and I did illustration and I did engraving and I did painting. I did all kinds of ways, you know, and didn't do much with it. Just kept it there rotting in a box or something. But the process is really the same, except that the physical focus is different, I think. The physical focus is much more complete in performance because both the voice and the body and the mind, everything is involved. Whereas in creating an object, you have that distance and you also have a completely different way of taking in time. Because when you make an object, you can work on that object as long as you want and come back and work some more, you know, maybe years later. And then space is different too, you know, because other people have to see that object and it has to be put somewhere where you can see it in a gallery, in a museum, in somebody's home, whatever it is. And then when people look at visual art, they have the option to either stand there and see it or move on and ignore it. Whereas, of course, when you get your ticket and you come into a theater to see a performance, you usually are a captive audience and you have to stay as long as the performance lasts. And so there's much more mastery and decision-making in making a performance as to space and time, you know. So there are those differences, but still I think one feeds the other, and that's why so many people who are either musicians like John Cage and dancers like Merce and, you know, whatever, they also drew and they also painted and they also used Sumi inks, you know, because one thing does feed the other and complements it.
In a postscript to the Moira Roth interview, you said that Routledge wanted to publish a book about your teaching methods, but you didn't have time to write it. And here it is 20 years later, and the book, The DBD Experience, Chance Knows What It's Doing, is slated to be released by Routledge very soon. Why has this book taken 20 years to write? Is this the definitive Rachel Rosenthal how-to book?
Well, it's how to for DVD, definitely, doing by doing. Well, I never thought that I would write the book, to tell you the truth, because writing the book means going into the past. And even though I've used the past a lot in my performances, this is not something I like to do particularly. What I like is to be in the present, in the now. You know, this is very Zen, but there it is. And so I just couldn't see myself sitting down and talking about something that is as ephemeral as DVD work. And, you know, whenever I teach with what's in front of me. If you are in front of me and you're going to work with voice, I'm going to respond only to what I see and feel and receive from you at that moment. So how do you put that into a book and make it into a rule or a, you know, a, something that you should be doing that way and no other way? You know, I didn't like that. And then about a year ago, something weird happened. I woke up in the morning, and without making any decisions or anything like that, I just walked to my computer, and the fingers continued doing the walking, and I had started the book. Whoa.
Chance knows what it's doing.
That's right.
Fantastic. This may be an odd question, but file name Future Facts was first performed in 1992, but you said it in the distant future of the year 2012, which now doesn't seem so distant. In that piece, you described your persona as an 86-year-old performer who looked 66, and you presented a harrowing cautionary tale that showed what would be left of the earth if we didn't change our ways. If you were to perform that piece today, and it was set in 2029 as a centenarian who looks 83, would you still have the same warnings for us?
Well, of course, because unfortunately, my pieces don't become old hat. They're always dealing with things which are happening now. And I wish, you know, that things had changed to the point where they become obsolete. But my pieces never become obsolete because we just don't learn and we don't do the way we should be doing, you know. So, yes, I would just push the year's nomenclature a little bit further up, but it would be the same. And I have to add, in that performance, I bring in gangs. And gangs are more proliferating now than ever, you know, and we're beginning to just bump them off as much as we can. You know, we're sending people with guns and they kill them. But in that piece, it's even really scary how much of that piece is what is happening now, you know? Hmm.
This is probably a trite question, but I feel like I have to ask it. You shaved your head. For many people, I think this becomes what they know about Rachel Rosenthal is
that she's and my rat.
That and your rat, which we can talk about too. So does it bother you that the shaved head is the way people identify you when there's so much more to you than that? I mean, and maybe I'm not being fair. Maybe that I don't think that's the only way people identify you, but it's almost like a shorthand of Rachel Rosenthal. Oh, she's the performance artist who shaved her head. Did you have any idea when you did that that this would become such a marker of who you are?
No. First of all, I thought that I would grow the hair back right away. And then I looked at myself and I said, this is how I feel. Finally, I look like the way I feel. So I kept it that way. And I had to shave every day because it was growing back every day, you know. So I don't care, you know, what people say about me, frankly. It doesn't matter to me, really. I mean, it makes me feel good, like everybody else, when people like what I do. But if they identify me one way or another, that's their problem, you know.
And talk for a little bit, because I saw in another interview just from a couple of years ago, you were talking about how, is it pronounced Tati?
Tati.
Tati. How Tati had hidden himself under your hair, and then when the hair was gone, there was no place for him to
hide. We started using beautiful scarves so he could have a little nest for
himself. Have a place.
Yeah.
Well, and that experience, I mean, having a dog or a cat, that's something that many people can relate to. Having a rat, that's something that's quite, people might say that's really different.
Except for those who are rat people who love them and understand them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of them.
And you've said that you felt a kinship with Tati that you had never felt with any other kind of animal. What was it about that experience that was so special?
Well, I think that rats are also very social beings. They like to be with other rats. And Tati was not. Tati was alone. And he transferred that feeling or that need to me. And we understood each other. I knew when he had to go to the bathroom. I knew when he was hungry, when he was sleepy. And unfortunately, rats don't live long. So I had him about 2.5 years, which is usually the amount of time that they live, although some rats can live longer. And he also put me in a certain place very graphically. The artist is a rat, is something that people fear, that people don't honor, that people are upset about sometimes, that people admire grudgingly, etc. And so Tati was all those things as a rat. And it was like a little symbol, small symbol that I carried along, you know, that said, we're rats, the two of us. And he helped me in many, many ways. It was a difficult period for me, I remember. And having him close to me like this on my body was different from most of the relationships that you have with other animals because they're too big for that. So when he died, it was a big, big loss for me. I had to readjust to a life without him.
Mm-hmm. I look at the course of your life and all of the artists that you have had the privilege of working with and of being with and living with. And it reads like a who's who of the important artists of the 20th century. Do you think back now about the serendipity of your life and all the ways in which these artists have shaped sort of who you are now? I mean, you could never have predicted that at the time. And yet you look back and you were with some of the most important artists that we will always be talking about of the 20th century.
Well, I was very lucky. You know, again, chance knows what it's doing. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time is all I can say, and accepted by them. And I always thought of myself as kind of like, you know, the royal clown, you know, the king's jester. Because I didn't know at the time that those artists were so much more advanced than I was. I was still trying to find myself, and they had found themselves very strongly already. So I learned so much from them, and sometimes in ways that I was not aware of, because we were just hanging out together, you know, and it wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. So I was just very lucky that way. And yes, I do think about it a great deal. I think about my life a lot. And sometimes I get memories of early childhood that hadn't entered my brain all these years. And suddenly, pop, there they are, you know. And it always amazes me how that works. You know, I have no idea how the brain really works, and nobody really knows. So it just pops up with these things. And then there are so many things that I completely obliterated that I have no recollection of it at all. And like, for instance, yesterday we went to my storage place because I wanted to look for some things to put in my silent auction that's going to happen soon. And I find documents, and I find letters, and I find notebooks, and I find works that were given to me or exchanged or that I bought. I have no recollection of what they are, who did them, who sent them, when, why, what, nothing. You know, it's a big blank. So I feel that I have to one day, you know, take the time to read this stuff and remember and all that. But I don't know if I'll ever do that.
Will the archive of your work and these collected writings and letters, will they go anywhere?
Yeah, we're working with Getty a little bit and see if we're going in that direction. You know, the problem is that I can't give a lot right now to anybody because I use this stuff. You know, it's important for me to know how I can put my finger on them. All I have millions of slides. I have millions of photographs, you know. So I cull a few. I take a few for my book. My book is number one in the trilogy. I want to have two more coming because I teach not only DBD, which is the basic, but also what I call the eight-week class, which is the advanced, and then Tohu Bohu, which is all improvisation. So I want to have a book for each one of these things, you see. And this business of my 83rd birthday, which is coming up, you know, I'm going to have a big bash, which will also be a fundraiser, because I need money, because I want to pay my artists for a change. Nobody pays the artists. They're the last ones to get paid, which I think is appalling. So I want to be able to pay my artists, so that's why I'm having this fundraiser. But it's going to be a very exciting party, I think. I hope you come.
I hope so. This may be an unrelated question, but with the passing of Merce Cunningham in July, was that a relationship that you had continued over the years? Were you still in touch with him, or?
Yeah, I was in touch with him and with Jasper. Everybody called him Jap, so it's hard for me to say Jasper, with Bob. The only one that I didn't have a big contact with was Cy Twombly, because he was mainly in Italy. And I was invited to Broad's for one of his big galas for Cy, but I didn't see him often. But It was not what it was, of course, when we lived under the same roof and we were continually with each other. But it was good to know they were there, and it's a big, big loss for me to know that they're not there, you know. That was very sad, especially since I really intend to live to 105. And I think anything below that is too young.
Well, I certainly hope that I'll be able to interview in another 20 years then.
We'll do this again. Yes, absolutely.
Very good. Well, Rachel Rosenthal, it's been my pleasure to talk with you today, and thank you for making this time.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you, too.
Thank you. This is Bradley Griffin for Ecumenica Journal. I've been speaking with performance artist Rachel Rosenthal. This interview was recorded October 23rd, 2009, on the campus of Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. Technical and financial support for this podcast have been provided by Pepperdine University's Office of University Communications and the Office of the Provost. The recording engineer was Nathan Pang.